Have you been completely nude?
I'm wearing as few clothes as I can right now.
Have you gone outside completely nude?
No, that might help a little.
And jumped into the ocean?
I'd have to drive to it, but yeah. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Nice, cool weather, Portland, Oregon. You are my co-host, Richard Wally.
And sopping on a puddle of floor like a melted ice cream cone, my co-host, Cassidy Robinson.
Yes,
in California.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm good even.
Good.
Yes, yes.
Good even. Why?
We bought a couch like a few weeks ago, and it was being custom made, and so it's taken a while to get here.
A custom made couch?
Yeah, we're fancy like that.
That is very fancy.
So we got half of it.
Uh-huh.
On Saturday. The other half didn't fit into our apartment, so we're getting that fixed right now.
Can you please describe to me and our listeners what this custom made couch is going to look like and why it's in two halves?
Well, it's a sectional. That's why it's in two halves. It's not like this ginormous, like Blue's Clues couch or something like that. I don't know where you were going with that, but we also got a not a sectional, but a thing you put your feet on.
A ottoman.
An ottoman. Thank you. See, you're fine. You're fine. I'm still doing the same things, but
hey, my father was an upholsterer, so I had to know these things.
Yeah, that's true. You've had years and years of practice.
Right.
No, but it's an ottoman that has like a tray that lifts up to you and becomes like a table. So
interesting. So you bought transformer couch and an ottoman.
Yes, both.
See, when you said came in two pieces, that's what I was thinking. It's like it was like some weird transformer
IKEA
couch.
Sure.
Yeah, where like you can like flip it around and reverse it and like, you know, turn it into a fort or something. I mean, you can do that anyway.
Well, I wouldn't. This thing's heavy. It's got a wood base.
Did they like measure your back and your butt and to make sure that you would like optimal comfort? Like a couch tailor?
Yes, we did. there's a small man that comes out of the back room and he measures your butt length. No. No, we just tried a bunch of couches and we said, "Oh, I can put my feet down on the floor on this one."
Mhm. Is that a big deal to you? You don't like to dangle?
No, I don't like to dangle. It
like
hurts
you're,
my back.
Like you're about to fly off in some sort of Six Flags roller coaster?
Yeah, I feel like a giant child, you know. I'm 30, I shouldn't feel that way. I mean, I'm 5'8", so I'm not very tall.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like there's been too many gaps in my life. I need to be able to touch the floor.
Thank you. Today we're going to be reviewing Straight Outta Compton. And at the end of the episode for our Netflix homework, we're going to be reviewing Housebound, which you assigned to me.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, we have a little bit of movie news, and I'll let you pick your first story.
So Tom Hardy.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of like that guy. He's a good actor.
He's pretty cool.
Yeah. He makes lots of noises, grunts and stuff.
Yeah.
But other than that, he's pretty cool. Actually, I like the grunts. But he's going to be in 100 Bullets adaptation. He's currently attached. Since this just got announced, I'm going to say it's still early in the process. He could drop or whatever. But for now, for those who don't know, 100 Bullets is like, it's a Vertigo title, which is a subsidiary of DC that do more adult, stranger adaptations of
comic
books.
Yeah.
Yes. And
it's like a crime.
Yeah, it's 100
series,
Bullets
right?
is like a crime vigilante kind of thing. Basically, a person has free rein for a certain amount of time to kill as many people as they please. But then once it's done, it's over. So
it's kind of like the Purge, I guess.
Sort of, except it's just one person.
Right.
It's to Purge, nobody else. And I believe the first one was, I haven't read it in a number of years. The first one I read was, it was like this, was this girl from the south side of Chicago. So, you know, it could be a very big stretch for Tom Hardy to play that, but I think it's in his wheelhouse. I think he could do that.
I think he could probably manage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know very little about the comic. I was just telling you, the only, my introduction to the comic even existing was this strange high school goth-ish kid who used to ride on my bus.
A bus weirdo, right?
Bus weirdo. Everyone has one. He was our designated bus weirdo. He's a kind of heavyset guy who always wore like a trench coat, like that kind of high school kid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he was going for like Columbine or Kevin Smith, somewhere in the middle probably. But
you also mentioned Juggalo at some point too.
Yeah, so. He's, I would call him like a proto Juggalo. Like he wasn't in high school, but it probably wouldn't take him very much to tip over to that edge. He used to bark at kids in the hallway. Anyway, if you're listening, get back to us. jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. What are you up to now? Are you a Juggalo? He used to read it on the bus, and I remember he was kind of showing kids around him like the violent parts or whatever to, so that they would be intimidated of him.
It wasn't that, it's not that bad. I mean, it is violent, but I don't know.
If you're like 16 years old and your base understanding of comic books is like Spider-Man or Archie or something,
well,
then it might seem kind of rough. If you haven't graduated yet to like Preacher, you know what I mean?
Well, once you know, I mean, there's nowhere to go from after Preacher, kind of.
Right. I read Johnny the Homicidal Maniac in high school because of another weirdo goth kid who was letting me borrow them.
Because you were a weirdo goth kid.
I like to think that I was like a delegate. I could kind of drift in and out of the different outsider weirdo cliques.
So you were just a stereotypical outsider weirdo.
Yeah, I mean, I got along with the gothy punky kids, but I was never really a gothy punky kid. And I got along with like the weirdo theater kids, but I wasn't really one of them either. I didn't really mesh all that well with the Magic the Gathering people, though. That was a separate group.
There was a lot of little niche groups within Century, now that I think about it. I kind of forgot about that.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's cool. I'll watch that movie.
What's your article?
My first article, my only article that I have up, actually, is... they picked a new director for that other Star Wars sequel. So the new one's coming out later this year.
J.J. Abrams.
J.J. Abrams doing Force Unleashed, was it called? No, that's a video game.
The Force Awakens.
Force Awakens. And he announced, kind of somewhat recently, that this is the only Star Wars he's doing. Got it out of his system, I guess. I don't know. He's had kind of a rough production. I'll be interested to see how this movie works, what with actors breaking their legs and whatnot.
Crashing planes.
Right. And yeah, there's been a lot of kind of weird stuff around this production. But so he says he's out after this. I think he's gonna maybe stay on as a producer or something like that, but they've picked a new director to take on the next sequel, which would be episode 8.
Well, no, this is for the third in this series, so this would be 9.
Oh okay,
because they've got the guy from Looper. I want to say Rainn Wilson, but I think that's the guy from The Office.
That's the guy from The Office. Rian Johnson.
Johnson, that's it.
Yeah. I forgot. I forgot if he was doing this sequel series or one of the standalones. It's hard to...
There's
so much Star Wars that's going to
be... There's so much of Star Wars happening.
Brace yourself. There's a lot of Star Wars coming. You can imagine, like, the Sean Bean...
Like, just meme. A tidal wave of TIE fighters coming over you.
Colin Trevorrow, who did Safety Not Guaranteed and most recently Jurassic World and made buttloads of money, boatloads, I'll say even, has now been attached, which makes a lot of sense because of the said money he's recently made. There's actually very few directors who I think could be trusted with such a big property when it comes to making their money back. So when you've just made the most money a movie's ever made, I think maybe almost now, isn't it?
It's past the Avengers, I know that.
Yeah.
But I think it's still in three. I think the one and two are pretty held in their respective areas.
Titanic or something like that.
Probably.
Yeah. So it makes a lot of sense that they would go to him immediately. And since I don't think he has a whole lot on his plate at the moment, it makes a lot of sense that he would say yes. Now, as somebody who was not a huge fan of Jurassic World, I can't say that I'm terribly excited about this news. Although, my problems with Jurassic World, I don't necessarily blame on him all the way.
Well, here's partly my take. Ryan Johnson is going to do the second one. That's the downer one.
Right.
You know, following the same kind of like, and then
that'll be their empire. It'll be all dark and whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And then Colin Tremo hid that long last name with a T.
Trevorrow. Like Trevor, but with an O.
You look like a Trevorrow. It sounds like a weird, like, insult in Russian to me. Colin Trevorrow is going to do the Ewok one.
Right.
And I mean, that makes sense to me. So in that sense, I'm like, okay, I see what they're doing.
I will reserve judgment for all of it until I see The Force Awakens. Because
that's probably true.
I really can't get a gauge for what the series is going for, what it's going to be tonally, how these older actors mesh well with the new ones, what the special effects are going to look like, other than the little bits I've seen in trailers. So I think once we get a good idea of what Abrams is setting up, then we can have a better idea of what this iteration of Star Wars wants to be.
Sure, sure. I was just saying my take is him as a director on it.
Yeah, I mean, I still adore Safety Not Guaranteed, but that's such a small movie, and it's such a, you know, personal movie in a lot of ways, that it's hard to really, you know, there's been a lot of, like, terrible directors who had great first movies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say if that's, like, his standard, or if that's just his little movie that he needed to get his name out there.
Right.
But we'll see.
My next news article is, this isn't a surprise to me, Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese are reuniting to do another movie.
Really?
Wow.
You don't say.
How many are there now? Like 20?
This has to be like close to like 7, 8, maybe even more.
For real. But what they're reuniting to do is Devil in the White City. Now, Devil in the White City is kind of, it's a story about two things. It's the story about the serial killer, one of the first American serial killers, H.H. Holmes, and his murder castle on the South Side.
Mm-hmm.
And Chicago, sorry.
Okay.
And then also, at the same time, the World's Fair is going on, and it talks about the journey of the guy getting that together. I can't remember his name, of course, because he wasn't a serial killer.
Oh.
but I have read the book. It's pretty good. It's really fun for historical. I was way more into actually the architecture and the building of the World's Fair than I was the information about H.H. Holmes, because I'd already known a lot of it, and it wasn't necessarily anything like that, like in depth. It just kind of gave a blow by blow of where he could have been and things like that.
Right. So it's a little bit more like a Summer of Sam approach, where he's sort of in the periphery of the story, but it sort of focuses more on the World's Fair. Well, or is it?
Kind of a compare and contrast, because what's interesting is they talk about the greatness of this head architect.
Yeah.
But I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people died in the process of doing this World's Fair. But the World Fair, you know, of 89 or something like that, or 88 in Chicago. It spawned all this like big ideas, and people really started thinking about the future, and it was really, you know, revolutionary at the time. It influenced Frank L. Baum to do the Oz series. It was a big deal. And
right.
But there's this weird comparison, because they're talking about, you know, H.H. Holmes and making his little murder castle, and this other guy making his grand, beautiful castle. But I think it goes back and forth. So I think it could be interesting. Also, they are talking about Leonardo DiCaprio playing H.H. Holmes. I think it'd be my take on it would be him playing both characters, the lead architect and the serial killer, but we'll see.
Be like a Man in the Iron Mask kind of thing?
No. Well, no. It would be more of a statement, thank you very much. You become a belligerent, mean man when you're all warm.
No, I'm joking. I mean, I don't know anything about this novel. It sounds cool from your description.
It's historical and a fairly easy read. I think this is a book I think you could get into pretty easily.
Because I'm an idiot and I need really easy books to read.
No, it's not like that kind of. It's an easy book to digest. It's easy on the tummy or on the brain pan, in this case.
You couldn't be less whatever it's called right now.
Oh, okay.
I need easy books. I'll take that back.
That's not what I'm saying.
I can't remember words.
Like, it's an adult book. It's for big people. Yeah, I'm just doing worse. This is
No, it sounds cool. I wonder if this is going to be more like the Shutter Island kind of Scorsese, where you kind of just sort of delves headfirst into B-movie territory.
Well, it has to be
if he's going to make a grander statement about America or something in like a Wolf of Wall Street sort of way.
Well, it has to be kind of maybe somewhere in between too, which would be really cool.
Yeah.
But I mean, there is no connection between the big architect and an H.H. Holmes. So,
mm-hmm.
So that's where it's kind of like, okay, what is the what is this story going to be and what is this movie? But it's Martin Scorsese, so I'm excited. So
yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll find out, I suppose. Is this supposed to be his next movie, or does he have something else on the pipeline?
Probably.
He always usually has a few
things. He's a sprightly old 80-year-old man, right. 70-year-old man. So
still doing it. Okay, well, before we get into the reviews, I did sort of have a pet topic. Mm-hmm. We don't have to spend a ton of time on it, but it was just sort of an idea I had the other day. A thought. I had this kind of idea, and I'm not the only one to have ever said this, but do you think that living in our day and age, going back to talking about branding ourselves and the internet and Facebook and social media, that in our day and age, people are less likely, you know, rather than posing as a question, I'll just pose it as a theory, and you can disagree with me if you think.
Sounds good. Sounds
my like theory sounds is that living in our day and age with social media.
Mm-hmm.
And with the internet and with the death of physical media and with things like Netflix as well as iTunes and those kind of things, that everybody, we're living in the society now where everybody can customize their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
You never have to endure something that you have no immediate connection to.
Sure.
On, you know, Spotify or iTunes and that kind of things, instead of listening to a whole album where you get the hits and the deep cuts, now you can just download the 5 or 6 tracks you've heard on the radio, and you will never have to know about the filler or the instrumentals or whatever kind of, you know, the eight minute closer and those kind of things on an album that, you know, used to be sort of a journey in and of itself. With film, you know, now instead of like going to a video store where you're walking around and looking and seeing what there is and having somebody suggest things to you or whatever, now you can just click on a few things like, oh, that sounds good, that sounds good, that sounds good. And then after that, it builds an algorithm and starts suggesting things to you based upon your star ratings and all of that kind of stuff. And of course, Facebook advertises directly to you. You've probably had the weird sensation where you look something up on Amazon and then all of a sudden it's advertising it to you.
Or sometimes when we buy board games, it automatically, like, there's an ad on another site that's for the expansion for it. And it's like, okay,
yeah,
that's enough, internet.
When I'm on YouTube now, like if I'm watching an interview with somebody on like Conan or something like that, and they make an offhand reference, mm-hmm. and I'm like, oh, I don't know what that is. So then I'll go like up to the search bar on YouTube and I'll put like the first two letters of that person's name, and it already knows that I want to look up that reference.
Right.
Based upon, I guess, a lot of other people doing that. So what I'm constructing here is I feel like we live in this world now where people can customize their own lives to exactly their interests. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I feel as though younger people who this is the reality they've always known, or for most of their teenage to adult life,
sure,
that they're less willing to peek into another world that is not exactly their own, and are less willing to see a movie that depicts a world that isn't their own or reflects their interests in some way. You know, step up to it with curiosity.
Sure, there's lower tolerance for something outside of their comfort zone, their bubble, their sphere of influence.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is pretty much true. I mean, I can't really say much more on top of that. I think that it is, I think that there are several byproducts of how we live now because of how technology and stuff like that has influenced it, influenced yeah. us. I do take the kind of Pandora's box approach to it, though.
What is that?
Well, there's no going back. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no putting the demons back in the box. It's already out there. The technology is already there.
Yeah.
And exists. And so in this, you know, I've heard within kind of the writing influence that the best way to really get somewhere anymore is by particularly catering to a niche, specifically being part of your own little, you know, neighborhood. But and in a way, it's sort of weird, too, because it does make you, even though you come back into your own sphere and it's your own, like, what surrounds you and people don't get outside of that bubble as much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would still say that people are more exposed than, let's say, before any of this technology existed. And they you never got out of your small town ever. That is where you were raised and you were at all times. And you never went further than this. People actually have the opportunities to see or to look if they have the predilection to.
Right. Well, it's this weird kind of catch-22 that's happened with the internet yeah. age, where the world has opened up wider than it's ever been before because of the internet, because, you know, information is widely available now and it's made, you know, incredibly public immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And so the world seems bigger than it ever has before, but it's also shrinking incredibly because of the very thing I'm talking about, where people can, you know, add to their newsfeed, RSS feeds or whatever. You know, if somebody posts something you don't like on Facebook, you can request not to see it
right.
or anything like it. And then Facebook can start to build an algorithm based on that. So it's also made it's kind of made everyone much more sort of secluded into their worlds.
Well, it's less willing to
experience. And maybe part of the reason that is because it's so big now, because well, there's also so much just out not, there, you want to, people are, if feel like there's too much noise.
Well, just even like talking to, you know, it's hard to talk to people outside of your, you know, your comfort zone.
Mm.
If somebody doesn't feel the exact same way as you, I've noticed younger generations, I feel like an old man. I've noticed, you know, kids younger than me, especially, like if you do introduce something or an idea or something, they're so used to that, just that chorus of Facebook people liking your comments that all have the same opinion as you, when they're challenged or a different opinion comes up, it's hard for them to kind of like, to really kind of be like, oh, that's okay. It's not that big a deal. Like, mm-hmm. I can still even like this person. Like, it automatically is like, oh, dislike. It's like, okay. There is none of that button on real life. You know what I'm saying? There is no special algorithm. I mean, it's kind of weird because this kind of gets us back into the weirdo on the bus thing. All the right. weirdos on the bus can find each other now with the internet. So
and in a big way have. And I think actually that's sort of a positive thing. I'd say that's one of the good things about
I think
this.
A positive and a negative, because of the negative you're talking about. It's systematic of the same thing where, you know, there's no difference between the two.
Mm-hmm.
You find your niche, you find the people that all agree with you.
And then but you're then, just in an ideological echo chamber forever.
Yeah.
Right. And you never grow and you never experience anything. And some people have even said, and maybe this is sort of alarmist, that people lack empathy now because they have such a hard time seeing beyond their own experience.
Well, I remember this is another kind of those hitches. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if I actually read this in a credible place or in a Facebook posting. but I remember reading a study about monkeys, and they're doing it on their kind of field, mm-hmm. of where basically when there was 50 monkeys in a group, if there was more than that, there would be a point in time where there would a schism happen. Mm-hmm. And they would divide into other, you know, like 30 tribes. Person groups, and there'd right. be two tribes instead of. And so people have kind of, I think it was kind of pointing out that on Facebook, that kind of happens too. And there's kind of a schism can happen in that way. So I mean, from my perspective, you know, human is a deep, really tribal creature. Mm-hmm. And the internet kind of interrupts that in a strange way. So,
but also enforces it at the same time.
Yeah, it kind of echoes itself. It's a strange right. it's a strange beast.
It's like an amplifier. It takes everything that that human beings are already sort of inclined to do, mm-hmm. and then just adds to it. It makes it much more aggressive and much more immediate. Right. We're looking at it really on a macro scale, but quickly before we move on to the reviews, on a micro scale, talking about pop culture and film. Mm-hmm. How do you think, do you think that people, kids, you know, even adults to some extent, I think, you know, we're slowly becoming conditioned, even if we knew something else when we were younger, are less likely to watch a movie that's outside of their experience. You know, we're reviewing a movie about South Central LA, African-American in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Do you think that has less appeal for somebody who's like really only likes to watch Marvel superhero movies now?
I don't know. This movie has done pretty well. So you could say that kind of disagrees in that sentiment, but
sure.
In a way I think it does, but I don't know. Like, I mean, this is one of those questions that's like unanswerable mm-hmm. and unknowable. I kind of thought you were going to get at the nostalgia factor, which I know is a big deal. When I was in my undergraduate doing my BA work, there was the big push was for nostalgia work in the realm of psychology. And as time has gone on, I've seen it more and more in product placement and more in like movies and music and all sorts of different places. And it becomes a strange place in that sense. But,
I think BuzzFeed kind of tapped into this a while ago. Mm-hmm. Well, I think actually there is like a section of BuzzFeed. There's so many sections in BuzzFeed. Who can keep up anymore, really? But there's like a whole section of BuzzFeed that's devoted to 90s stuff. Mm-hmm. Quizzes, listicles, articles, and, you know, just like old advertisements from YouTube, whatever it is. They just like shove in this whole section of just 90s-ness. And I kind of feel like that's part of sort of what I'm talking about. It's like they see this generation that grew up then, mm-hmm. and they said, you know, here's this conversation that we can keep going.
Well, I mean, that's kind of, I think, part of the thing. One thing that I've recognized when not being on Facebook right now, I don't know, like most of the time it just seems like the same noise over and over and over again. It feels like something crazy is happening. So
no, yeah, I mean, even though I have it open generally all the time. Mm-hmm. It gets to the point, yeah, where it's just like you've seen the same article from the same 12 people over and over and over again, and it seems like even if it's like a big deal, it mm-hmm. like renders everything numbing within an hour.
Right. It kind of produces almost like an apathetic, like this comes back into your, you know, comes back into the thing you've been talking about is mm. that, yeah, it creates like, you know, there are things that I agree with, you know, politically. And then when I see it 12 times, I get kind of sick of it and I don't want to hear about it.
Yeah. You almost,
even though I completely agree and think it should be fought for.
Right. You start to disagree with your own side because you're like, all right, enough with it already.
Right.
Cecil the Lion. I get it.
Let's kill lions. All of them. They don't need to exist on the planet. Right. Right.
So sick of this dead lion. Luckily that story is kind of arced already, but All right. Well, I don't know if we got anything accomplished with that discussion, but it just kind of popped in my head. And I've been thinking about it a lot in terms of how people experience media now.
Well, I think it's
important. Almost a McLuhan-esque kind of theory that deserves and probably has already garnered book deals. So,
well, we don't actually like do this, but this is kind of stuff we always talk about on our off time, not on the podcast reviewing stuff. And so I think it's important to sometimes because it is something that I think affects us. And when people are like, oh, I'm so sick of like hearing about the internet and technology and how much it's affecting us. It's like, well, it's kind of important. So,
all right, well, let's go ahead and move on to the reviews.
Yeah, because we got in crazy town.
We're getting way off the path here. Today we're going to be reviewing Straight Out of Compton, which is directed by F. Gary Gray, the same director who directed the Ice Cube comedy Friday way back in 1994. And, he's done Be Cool and A Law-Abiding Citizen. He's been around. He's done things. The Negotiator. He's a guy. Here he's kind of going back to the well, doing a biopic or biopic. We had an argument with my friends recently. How do you pronounce it?
How do I?
Is it biopic or biopic?
Biopic. Biopic, that's ridiculous. Whoever said that is wrong.
I think I use them interchangeably. Anyway.
Well, you're only half right then.
Right. Half of the time I'm wrong.
Yes.
This is a biopic about the rap group known as NWA that came out of Compton, South Central LA, back in the late 80s, early 90s, and essentially, arguably, started gangster rap, an entire genre of hip-hop.
They at least popularized it, yeah.
Certainly popularized it, and certainly made it much more visceral and more in your face than it had ever been at that time. Ice-T had done a few things, like he did, you know, Colors, and he released a few songs and whatever that kind of talked about the streets and hustling and that kind of stuff.
Pop Killer.
Body Count would have been after N.W.A. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
I was just saying that because I love that song.
NWA was really kind of a force to be reckoned with. And I think it's kind of hard really to think about it now because we sort of take that sort of thing for granted, that kind of attitude and that kind of in-your-face-ness of hip-hop culture. It's kind of like a given now.
Well, this reminded me of a time when it did kind of mean a little bit more, at least to me it did. I think even the movie kind of brings it up. There's this ridiculous time where all the little white kids from middle America were all wanting to be underprivileged black kids from a poor neighborhood in California.
Right. Well, this kind of goes back to the discussion I was bringing up, the people becoming more curious about a world outside of their own rather than sort of immediately scoffing at it or whatever. This really opened up the world in a big way. Music like this and the people that came out of this band in particular, Dr. Dre and Ice Cube and Eazy-E. This pretty much chronicles their career starting from the streets, where some of them were legitimately gangsters and some of them weren't. But they kind of grew up in the same neighborhoods and they were dealing with the same sort of oppression from the police and from society at large, and as well as the gangs, and was reporting it as they saw it in their reality, which seemed pretty extreme for everyone outside of that reality. The FBI gets involved. The band starts to squabble over who's getting more money, more problems. I've heard before.
A Biggie Small song, yes.
What did you think of Straight Outta Compton?
I really dug this film. But when I put on my like reviewer hat, I can't say that it was necessarily that like the best biopic in the world. But it touches on a lot of things that are prescient right now.
Yes.
Or not, and it really. I, in a way, it makes me feel like we've gone absolutely nowhere in the last 3 years. But then I don't know. It reminds me of a time where you were kind of already talking about it. It reminded me of a time where like gangster rap and hip hop and stuff like that was actually a little bit more like there was some backbone behind it. It wasn't just boats and hoes.
Right.
And I mean, for I will say, I mean, yes, that's my own opinion, but I there became a point where it just became oversaturated and became very mundane, I guess. I don't know what the word is, but
Well, I guess you could say that like the genre became so solidified once the tropes are kind of laid out of what that genre was, that by the end of the 90s it started to become a parody of itself. But that happens every cultural revolution.
That's true. And so I don't know. It conjured a lot of things because there was the nostalgia that I was talking about here. There was, I think that there's a handful of great performances. I think that there's, I think that there's some good storytelling. Mm-hmm. It's just, it was just kind of as an actual like put together thing. Like it might be a little forgettable, but I enjoyed myself while I was watching it. I liked a lot of the messages that it was going, that kind of came up. Uh-huh. And I liked that it didn't portray everybody besides Suge Knight as completely good or completely bad. Uh-huh. Besides Suge Knight, he was just a bad guy. The AIDS message was, that obviously got to me because of history. People probably don't know, and it's a little personal. I usually don't talk about this kind of stuff, but my uncle died of AIDS when I was about 21, 22. He was kind of a big part of my life. And so, I mean, that obviously got me very emotional and really kind of attached me to the story in another way. Mm-hmm. But in general, there's a lot about this that really does kind of speak about our times, which is sort of weird because, again, these are events that happened 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I think it's really funny that O'Shea Jackson Jr. is just Ice Cube's like literal son is playing him in the film. That's very strange and he was kind of good though. So I don't know. It was sort of weird.
I'm not even sure if it's his son or if he just cloned himself.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
If it's just a joke. Yeah.
I didn't know where you were going with that.
if he just like dollied the sheep himself, because if you look at like pictures of him at that age, he's a dead ringer.
Well, at the end they show you pictures of Ice Cube and
some video footage and stuff.
And at first I was like, oh, they don't look that similar, because you know, my most recent are from like 21 and 22 Jump Street and stuff. That's where I think of Ice Cube from.
Yeah.
But then when they had those older pictures, I was like, man, he looks so much like his father. Holy cow. He
sounds exactly like him. And you know, people might think of it as stunt casting because it kind of is, but he's really good in this movie, and it's more than just an impression. He like embodies, you know, I've never seen this guy in another movie, so I can't really speak as to like how far from the apple fell from the tree as far as personality goes, but he gets not only his personality right and his scowl and his, you know, his, but he also raps exactly mm-hmm. like him. And like, and he's also, doing more than just an SNL impression here. He's a full fledged character that I was able to feel for and like root for in some places. And, you know,
he's had 20-odd years of practice.
Oh yeah. To get an observation.
To get it down.
And how weird that must have been for him to do, you know, because you never see your parents as they are. You always see them through the filter of, you know, a lot of things. And growing up with Ice Cube as a celebrity, I'm sure that even like adds 7 or 8 more filters that a normal person doesn't have about their parents. So I can't even imagine what the process acting wise of like getting to that headspace was like, but no, he's an incredible new talent, and I could see him, you know, becoming a thing in film just as his father did.
I also thought Eazy-E was pretty, he did a pretty good job.
Right, the actor who plays him here, Jason Mitchell.
Yeah.
And Corey Hawkins is Dr. Dre. And it's really interesting to see, like, you know, one of my favorite sequences really of the film was the introduction of each character. I thought
where you get the setting. You get the setup to where it was. I thought that was the best part of the film as well.
Right. And, you know, I mean, which isn't to say that the movie's all downhill from there, but I think that, you know, the way they set up the character is so clever because you see, A, it introduces each character and gives them kind of, you know, that celebratory moment of, you know, respecting the person they eventually become. But also shows this world in a really clever way and the different facets and, you know, shows who was really in it and was, you know, really, you know, selling the drugs and shooting the people and all that stuff and who wasn't and how those worlds kind of became intertangled either way.
Well, how they were both part of just the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know,
and how it all sort of influenced everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that stuff was really strong and I like, you know, seeing the band come into their own and, you know, seeing the in and outs of, you know, what it was to be NWA in the early 90s and, you know, going into the LA riots and Rodney King and all of that stuff and all of these historical beats. I will agree with you, though. I feel like the movie is a little too comprehensive on the history and a little too broad. And I think that it's like 2.5 hours, I want to say. And it definitely could have used a tighter edit. And I think by the middle of the movie, once NWA is more or less broken up, and then we start to get into Dr. Dre's solo career, Ice Cube's solo career, then they start to introduce, you know, other LA hip hop people like Snoop Doggy Dogg and
While we're on that note, the actor that plays him,
mm-hmm.
he was also in Dope and The Purge 2. For some reason, I really like him as an actor. His name's Keith Stanfield. I don't know what it is about him, but there's always, like, it seems like every so often, there's always this actor I'll see in these little parts all over. Mm-hmm. I'm like, man, somebody should really write a film for that guy.
Right.
He has such a specific look that it's I don't know. They need to do a Star Wars spinoff movie with him in it.
With
something.
Just him.
Yeah, just him as a person. Oh my gosh, I'm in the Star Wars. I don't know.
But I guess where I'm going with all of this is that by the end of the movie, I felt like it was starting to become a little unwieldy and it was starting to lose focus of the specifically of NWA and sort of what they meant and sort of what the film as a whole means. Because, you know, if you look at what the story is, you know, what's the bare bones of what this is about, you know, rather than like centering everything around something like the LA riots or something like that and making it more a political statement, it starts to just become essentially a rise and fall, you know, flew too close to the sun kind of movie, which is a pretty standard trope in these sort of celebrity biopics.
In a biopic about, well, yeah, it's, I mean, maybe that's just the the general life of somebody in this kind of world, but
right, and it's a clear story that was already there built into the narrative and one that you could tell. I just feel like there's two ways to do these kinds of movies. You can either tell the whole story, which is what they chose to do, which is, you know, go from the beginning to the very very end and everything in between and let the story stuff kind of bubble up to the surface. I was wondering how far they were going to go. I was like, are we going to get into like East Coast versus West Coast and like Biggie and Tupac and like how far are we going to keep going on this timeline? Because it was starting to get a little bit like Walk Hard. Well, like where,
yeah,
meet my friend John Lennon. Like, you know what I mean?
Like, well, specifically the stuff with Dr. Dre, which I love Dr. Dre.
Mm-hmm.
But his specific storyline is, I think, the one that led you the furthest away and was the most distracting. So.
Right, I think they felt like there was a little bit of fan service that they, for whatever reason, felt like they needed to pay lip service to. They needed to show, like, yeah, this is the same guy who did The Chronic, and L.A. West Coast hip-hop was a big deal in the early 90s, and that's all well and good, but that I feel like that did feel like a distraction, and it started to feel a little bit like a VH1 original TV movie by the end of the movie.
Well, it does. And I do think that the quality of the film, I wouldn't say I'm kind of a sucker for some of these. I'll be honest,
mm-hmm.
for some of these, especially if it's, you know, like the Johnny Cash one.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that biopic, but it is kind of a biopic by the numbers. This follows a similar pattern to that one.
Right.
And I, with this one specifically, it did have a strong connections and strong emotional ties and stuff like that. And they could have played that card instead of going
full life. The other, rather than telling the whole story from the end and just, you know, hit all the historical beats along the way, I would have, and what I thought they were going to do based upon the trailers was they were going to tie it more into the LA riots and sort of Rodney King and sort of tying that history up with ours, with our current racial issues. And that all of that kind of works itself in anyway, just because.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that there could have been a more succinct and more economic and clearer way of telling the story than the one they chose to do.
Well, what I feel like, and I know a little bit about the development, that specifically at first this was supposed to be a biopic about Eazy-E.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like you can really feel like that there were other parts added.
There's a few movies competing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I specifically feel like the Dr. Dre one is the weakest link. And I feel like that Eazy-E through line, because he is, and his, he does reference the riots a lot. He does say this is bad. He does, you know.
Right.
Well, and
everyone gets involved at, you know, one point or another.
Right.
And, you know, for all of the criticisms I have about the storytelling here, I do think that there is something kind of magnetic about the movie, regardless. It's kind of a Shaggy Dog, but I think that there is a vitality to this, maybe in part because of the recent news of, you know, ton of police brutality issues that doesn't seem to be letting up.
Well, it was well acted, and I think that they balanced it correctly.
Right.
Because, like, even, like, the...
And there's a passion in the filmmaking that's very tangible.
Right. And I think even the stuff with... One of somebody that we haven't mentioned, that he was good, and it was Paul Giamatti.
Yeah.
And they kind of... They go back and forth on specifically, like, the anti-Semitic comments and stuff like that, and they talk about that. And that's sort of also an interesting caveat and kind of a commentary. And I feel like a moment where they're kind of like bringing it back on itself,
mm-hmm.
and being like, well, but what about this?
Right.
What about
kind
this?
Of, kind of exposing kind of... some hypocrisies and.
Right.
Right.
Well, and, even the funniest one to me is the, that all of the main Ice Cube, Dre and Eazy-E, the way that they all solve their problem was by marrying a sensible woman. Like, no, it's true, but then there's obvious sexist problems within that community and even shown in that film. And so it was sort of funny that it doesn't seem like they were trying to make that comment, but to me it was kind of like that's how the comment kind of came down, was like, oh.
Going back to Paul Giamatti a little bit, because I did want to, like, because I do think it's a really strong performance, also a very important one for the movie, given that a big part of the plot here, which maybe didn't need to be as big as it ended up being, it is about who's getting what money from who. Paul Giamatti, we should say, played Jerry Heller, who was the original manager of the band,
mm-hmm.
And sort of discovered all these kids out of Compton, and sort of as a white, you know, well-to-do Jewish industry guy, sort of introduced them to the world in a big way. But I think they, you know, as he is written on the page, he's a little villainized, I think, largely.
Really?
But I think that Giamatti is such a good actor that he infused all of this kind of pathos and kind of sadness into the character, and sort of this yearning to keep him from becoming that completely.
See, and I thought that the moment, there's this moment later in the movie when they're talking about the money,
mm-hmm.
And there's the end parting between Eazy-E and him.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert. I think that moment is acted really well and is a very strong piece. And it was all based on acting choices. Well, I think you're right, but I think that it also, it kind of brings up a bigger commentary about, like, they're, you know, it's just business. No, it's just business. Your economic problems is just business, even though I'm doing fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. And it's sort of, I don't know. I thought that was sort of interesting, and a better movie was being told there. But then we get back into the whole Tupac Shakur and which
and Suge Knight and all of that stuff. And I feel like that's another movie. Like
that is another movie.
If they wanted to have done a sequel to this, then you could have done the Dr. Dre story, or the the story of Death Row Records. I don't think that that's necessarily the same movie as N.W.A.
Right.
And
that, I think that was the most, that, I mean, I've brought that up several times, but I think that was the most distracting part. And I think I think the through story of Eazy-E from the start to the end is very strong.
Yeah. And Ice Cube. I mean, I think once you get to the core of what that group was and like, it does eventually come around again. Right. That stuff always felt vital and strong and there, and then, yeah, some of the other stuff, some of the side stories felt a little bit more behind the music.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think it's not a perfect film by any means, but I think it's definitely worth seeing. And I think it is interesting that this movie's coming out now, not only because of the racial tensions between the police and minorities that still exist, but also because of just how much history has passed since this album came out and this band came out. And at the time, a lot of this music, and them in particular, was sort of just dismissed as shock value and, you know, of no real substance or content. And now, with all of this stuff passed, they have kind of earned their own kind of place in rock and roll history as being sort of the Sex Pistols of their generation.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
The Black Flag of their generation, you know, something that's kind of more culturally relevant and specific and important.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I know that, when the big bomb hit, it was Snoop Dogg, Dr. Dre, and all those. And I guess that's why they felt like that needed to be tied in.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, even I kind of go back and forth because I did like the kind of message there. That Dr. Dre had to leave Death Row Records to get away from that like gangster element. I don't know. Sorry, I'm trying to figure out like exactly why that's, and it must be those just guest appearance things. I'm not really sure, but I'm trying to figure out exactly the mechanics right there.
Right, but the story kind of, it sort of just splits.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of, snake forks. You know, fork tongue kind of ducktails towards the end, and it kind of starts going two separate directions. And either of those stories is interesting on their own, but they start competing with each other structurally, and that's when it starts to feel kind of uneven and unfocused. There's that.
So I think we're both pretty positive on it.
I'm pretty positive on it. I think, you know, it's a 2.5-hour movie, and like I said, it's not a perfect film, but it does feel vital in a way that's really interesting. And also, I'm all about cultural specificity.
And it does more or less work.
Yeah. Okay, let's go now into the Netflix homework, which you assigned last week.
I sure did. This is a New Zealand horror film. Horror comedy really is probably a better way to say it.
Right.
It's about a troubled young youth that is literally, she's put on house arrest into her family's home.
What's the name of the movie?
Housebound. Basically, she's like this troubled youth. She's kind of a brat, really.
Mm-hmm.
And she's locked with her mom, who's kind of a twit. But they end up kind of getting into this weird, haunted story thing happening. I don't want to get too much into it because it kind of takes some fun twists and turns and stuff like that.
Right.
But I really like this movie. I think it has a really weird tone because it's super serious, but the characters are just so funny that it is kind of funny. So it walks this weird line. I also like a lot of the characters that they introduce. I just think that they're kind of fun and interesting and kind of quirky. It all pulls together in kind of a fun, almost whodunit sort of way. So,
mm-hmm. This is directed by Gerard Johnstone. I don't know if he's done anything else of note, anyways. And it does kind of feel very much in that tradition of sort of the New Zealand style of horror comedy. We talked about earlier in the year the New Zealand vampire film They Walk Among the Shadows.
The comedy horror,
which is a lot more kind of explicitly comedic than this movie is. But there is kind of, you know, a similar tonal vibe in some of the stuff there, as well as the film Black Sheep, not the Farley, Chris Farley.
Oh.
Yeah, not that one.
Oh, I see.
The one about actual literal zombie sheep. But they're as well as, like, going back to the Peter Jackson stuff. Who maybe sort of in a way introduced this subgenre that seems to be somewhat prevalent there still. And this one does, I think, ride a more careful line between the two tones. It seems to play very broad and satirical sometimes, and a little bit more kind of that dry wit and goofiness.
It strikes a weird balance, like I said before. It's almost hard to explain because I don't feel like I've seen it in a lot of other horror comedies.
Mm-hmm. Where it rides right up to the edge. Tonally, as far as that way, where you're never... Where they take the comedy just as serious as they take the horror.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe John Landis's first werewolf.
Werewolf in London.
Yeah, I think that one is a little bit closer here to this, where it's a horror movie that has funny parts in it, but not necessarily a straight comedy.
Well, it seems like it's a horror movie. It's just the people that happen to be being scared or booed are funny or quirky in some way.
Sure, kind of maybe more like a Coen Brothers sort of way.
Yes.
Like in a Fargo sort of way, where if you look at the story and, you know, and what's happening, it's... a noir. It's a thriller noir, but it just happens to be that the characters are so funny just because they're of the way they act and talk and react to things.
I always wonder if I say this because specifically it seems like with New Zealand,
mm-hmm.
like that happens a lot. They're like, "We're not funny, you dicks. This is very serious, you know."
We're way out. I mean, there's some stuff in here. I think they know what they're doing.
Oh, I do too. I think that they're walking the line like perfectly, which I don't know if I've ever seen in this kind mm-hmm. of film. It seems like they lean one way or the other more. But just some, I was just watching, we just got done watching Flight of the Conchords. So mm-hmm. that's why I was just like,
Well, they're almost like the Canadians of Australia.
Right.
Like they're just a little more quirky, a little, and then kind of like nice to a suspicious nature.
Well, I like the episode where they talk about, this is Flight of the Conchords where they call the Australian, it's like a New Zealand accent, but evil. Australian one. I thought that was wonderful.
But yeah, I liked everybody in this movie. I thought they all did a good job. Morgana O'Reilly plays the main character, this kind of troubled youth who goes back to live with her mother. And it seems like, you know, the obvious subtext here, which they say out loud more than once, is, you know, it's kind of this prodigal daughter story gone awry. And I think that plays out pretty cleverly. There are a lot of red herrings in this movie, though. And I think they're kind of playing around with that, and I think they're, you know, they're having fun in that sort of way of like keeping you guessing. Mm-hmm. But there's maybe one or two red herrings too many. Because I was thinking about it by the end of the movie, it's like, oh, they introduce this character, they introduce that character, then they introduce that character, and it's like you're supposed to believe that it could be a number of different things, and I feel like that maybe steps on the simplicity of the comedy and the storytelling a little bit.
I see, and I think it's just part of the fun of the movie, but it's fine. That's your viewpoint. But to me specifically, I like the kind of the red herring element of it because it is a classic whodunit. But mm-hmm. like watching this with somebody who is pretty drunk and one of those people that like yells out things at movies.
Yeah.
Like yelling out at like in honest reaction.
Mm-hmm.
The person who did it, who was doing it, literally yelled at like every character. So in a way, I think it's kind of funny. Like, I think it really works because I think that they paid attention to be like, oh no, we're doing this. Like,
right.
Like, well, we're almost making fun of that.
Well, and I think a lot of the different characters and stuff that they introduce, because at one point they introduce this crazy neighbor character who skins rodents, and at one point, you know, her father or father-in-law seems kind of strange in his own way. Different police that are, you know, on her because she's on some sort of probation. So there's all these different characters around her, and I kind of feel like each one. The director is kind of making direct reference to different horror tropes in each red herring. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I kind of feel like he's trying to include all of those so that he can kind of riff on those tropes. And maybe for me, it would have been a little stronger if he narrowed the scope. I feel like that's been my goat this week as far as movies go. If he narrowed the scope a little bit, he could have focused more on sort of one generic trope or a couple, and it would have felt a little less like he was trying to have every cupcake and eat it too.
But I thought that was part of the fun, but
yeah,
and purposeful. So that's just where I'm going to have to disagree on that
part. Well, I'm not doubting that it's purposeful. I know what he was trying to do. I think as far as the story goes, as far as the comedy goes, it starts to become a little like, I guess it comes down to where's the movie stronger in your opinion, the horror stuff or the comedy stuff. And I felt actually the movie could have been a tad funnier.
Well, would you say that that's a nitpick? Would you?
No, I'm just looking at the movie structurally and
okay. Well, I feel like it's a little like dissecting, and I don't think that it necessarily is completely there, but that's okay.
I hated it, Richard.
I know.
It's my least favorite movie I've ever seen. And I hate you.
Good.
Because you made me watch it. No, I had a lot of fun with the movie. I think that if you're a big fan of like the New Zealand style of sort of dry wit and horror comedy that they've done, you know, any of the movies that I mentioned before, as well as maybe even like some of the Edgar Wright stuff like Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, this kind of in some ways reminded me of those movies.
It almost reminds me more of those, because when you brought up, I didn't think of the immediate connection between this and Werewolf in London, which I think is maybe a little bit more similar than like a Black Sheep or like Dead Alive. I mean, like those films go above and beyond, and I feel like this one
more slapsticky in a way.
Yeah, and I don't feel like this one does this. I think this one is almost like, you know, gothic horror version of those movies.
Yeah, it's playing around in that genre a lot. But yeah, I think it's a interesting bobble of a genre film.
Okay.
I enjoyed it.
It was perfect. You're wrong.
Next week, I'm going to have us watch the film that I actually know little to nothing about, called The Cook, The Thief, The Wife, and Her Lover.
Why did you pick this one? Just curious.
It has
just
a bit of a reputation, I suppose. It's a little bit of an art house film that came out in the early 90s, and what it's mostly known for is it was one of the first movies that was rated NC-17 that got a lot of attention. And I've seen that filmmaker's other film, The Pillow Book, which was like one of many Ewan McGregor doing full frontal movies from the 90s.
Should I be worried? Is that where this
is going?
I don't
know. I've seen the movie on lists and stuff, so it's a movie that, you know, people who like movies are supposed to know about. And it's been on Netflix for a while, and I've wondered. So we'll take a look at that next week. Okay. And if anyone has anything else to say about anything we talked about today, whether it's Housebound, if you happen to see it, or Straight Outta Compton, where were you in the early 90s? Were you born in the early 90s to be able to listen to those albums?
There's this weird thing. We've been doing that where we've been asking a hypothetical audience. But every once in a while when you do it, I start to answer the question. So.
If you have anything to say about anything, you can email us at jabberandrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/jabberpodcast. It's been a while since we've had anyone join the Facebook, so you should definitely do that. Find us there, and we post all of our news articles, and sometimes we'll engage listeners if they happen to comment on something. We're also on Twitter, @jabberbot, podcast, all one word. We're on iTunes and Stitcher Radio, where you can leave us a 5-star rating and a 1-sentence review. We would love if you did that. We're also searchable under the Zune and Windows Podcast Network, as well as Pocket Cast. You can read my reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com, although I haven't posted one in a while because I'm somewhat lazy. I also have some reviews and articles on the Seattle-based entertainment site MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Richard started a blog something like 2 years ago and wrote like 3 things for it. Call rdwally.weebly.com.
I prefer that way.
Is that
you introduced it? That's the good way.
I just did it right.
I also don't do a lot on it because I'm lazy. That's the consistent theme between us, apparently.
Yeah, tonight I'm going to try and post my Mission Impossible review and my Trainwreck review, which I never posted. And be sure to listen to our friends Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa over at their podcast, Quarter Life Crisis, at quartercrisis.podbean.com, as well as Leland over in Olympia, Washington, at his comedy podcast, dampercast.com, as well as friends of the show who were going to be doing a guest appearance on his podcast, Make Dad Read Comics, Patrick and his dad over there in Detroit. I think we'll be doing that sometime next month.
I'm super excited for that. I'm pumped.
I'm sure you are. Finally get to like.
I get to talk comics finally.
Yeah.
not be sidelined when that's not what we're talking about. We're here to talk about movies, Richard. And I'm like, bullshit. This is my podcast too. We will talk about everything besides movies. Food.
I think we get a lot of comic talk in this podcast for a podcast that's not directly about that.
I think we do a lot of talk about a lot of things.
Maybe too many things.
We talked a lot about couch. Yes. It should be a movie review podcast, but it's really more like a
this
life
week,
review podcast.
Right. This week was couch cast.
Yes.
We'll talk to you later.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.